Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Fred Astaire started out as an unlikely leading man. Can't act, can't sing, said his first screen test results. But with skill and persistence, he made the swing from vaudeville to Hollywood legend look like an effortless tap dance. And he did it all in a top hat, white tie, and tails. This hour On Point, the remarkable art and life of Fred Astaire. You can join the conversation. Did you grow up watching Fred Astaire's footwork in movies like Top Hat, Swing Time, and The Gay Divorcee? Does putting on the Ritz make you get up and dance? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We just came in with some tap dance from Puttin' on the Ritz, a song first recorded by Fred Astaire for the 1946 film Blue Skies. Joining me now from Evanston, Illinois, is Joseph Epstein, eminent American essayist and cultural critic. His new book is Fred Astaire, part of the American Icon series from Yale University Press. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, where you can also check out some iconic Astaire movie clips. Joseph Epstein, thank you very much for being with us.
A pleasure to be here, Jane.
Great to have you. What was the magic of Fred Astaire, simply put?
Well, I can't put it simply. That's the darn problem. This whole book is about trying to find that magic. And the thing about magic, I fear, is, you know, if you find it and explain it, poof, it's gone. What is going on in the whole Fred Astaire transaction, I think, is people who have seen his movies feel this strange combination of admiration, nostalgia, and perhaps above all, fantasy. Women imagine themselves dancing with him. Men imagine being him. I felt it when you were playing your introductory music. My legs are jumping around under my desk
here. It does make you want to dance. Me too, me too.
Absolutely.
So Frederick Austerlitz was his born name, given name, right?
Correct. He was born, you should know, in Omaha, Nebraska, which is not what one would think, you know, from the great sheen of sophistication that his performance gave. His father was an immigrant. His mother was born in Omaha. They married very early. His father had odd jobs. He worked as a salesman of various kinds, later toward the end as a beer salesman. They were really rather lower middle class, the family was. And in fact, I think it was owing to the snobbery, the sort of small town middle western snobbery of Omaha, that when the children were eight, Adele was Fred's older sister and Fred was then six, the mother took them away from Omaha to New York, hoping for a career for Adele more than Fred. Adele was a great sort of natural beauty and filled with talent and quite a magical character on her own. But it was, as she felt, I think, that in Omaha, the deck was stacked against her and her children. There was a great sort of talent show that I mentioned in my book, and the Astaire kids, who were blazingly talented from a very early age, didn't make it, and they didn't make it because they're from one of the better families. They weren't from one of the better families. So
he did display early talents then.
He did, but she even more.
His sister Adele.
Yeah, she was just one of these natural, dazzling beauties. She was a remarkable woman in every way.
I write in the book that George Bernard Shaw called her one of the most beautiful women I'd ever met.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. When you look at photographs, you've probably noticed this before. She's pretty enough, but it must have been in the coloring, the animation. Have you ever noticed, you know, a couple they always talk about as being dazzling is F. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. And you look at them and you say, well, they're okay, you know, but they're not. But in life, something extraordinary must have emanated from them. And I think this was true of Adele. She was the kind of young woman where, you know, every man in the room had to turn and look at her. And she was vivacious. She was outspoken. Give you an an idea of Adele, what a great sort of character she was. There's a story that keeps going on that Fred Astaire, the Astaires, Austerlitz Astaires, were Jewish. I wasn't able to find that they were, but I think I know the origin of the rumor, the story, and it's that in the 30s, in England, when Hitler was getting going in Europe, the actress Lily Palmer, a Jewish Austrian, who was a friend of Adele's, someone in Adele's presence made some anti-Semitic crack about Lily Palmer. And Adele said, "You better take it back, kiddo, because I'm Jewish too, and I'm not going to take any of that crap from anyone." She wasn't, but that's the kind of person she was. When Fred married later on, she knitted a needlepoint for his and his wife's house in Beverly Hills. And on one side, it said, "Home, sweet home." On the other side, it suggested one do something anatomically impossible with oneself. You know, that was her.
Let's listen to a clip from a 1926 recording of Fascinating Rhythm with Fred and Adele Astaire. This is from the musical Lady Be Good with George Gershwin on the piano.
Fascinating rhythm, got me on the go. Fascinating rhythm, I'm all the great world. Lot of mission making, the neighbors want to know why I'm always shaking just like a little bird. Each morning I get up with a sigh, start a hopping, never stopping. By that night the work has been done. I know that life's been better.
That's from the early career of Fred Astaire. He struggled to make it in the beginning. As I mentioned, his first screen test said, "Can't act, can't sing. Balding, can dance a little," end quote. So how did he get out of his sister's shadow? How did he get his start?
Well, you know, it was a brother and sister act. And they were a great success in Europe, in England especially. Noel Coward said, you kids really must come to England. They'll love you. You are the smart kind of couple the English love. And it turned out to be right, and royalty took them up and all sorts of things. Such that Adele, in fact, married an Englishman, a man named Cavendish, who was one of the sons of the Duke of Devonshire, and she remained in England. Adele never had the same appetite for dance that Fred did. Fred was the worrier of the team. He was the perfectionist, and she was sort of more of a natural.
And he was a workhorse.
Oh, immensely so, yes. I mean, the only argument he ever had with the studios that he worked for was he wanted more rehearsal time.
Right.
And there's stories of dance partners with, you know, bleeding feet. They went over things so often and again, revising dances. So he was sort of cut adrift, and he came back to America, and he was offered this chance in the movies. I think it was David Selznick I think it was Zanuck, General Zanuck, who said, the story about that screen test is one doesn't know if it's true or not, whether it's Balding can't sing, dances a little. But Zanuck said, I don't like his jawline, and his ears stick out terribly. And he had very thinning hair early in life. But there's something extraordinary about him. Let's give him a shot. So the first movie he did, he appeared under the name of Fred Astaire dancing with Joan Crawford. And then there was another movie he did with Ginger Rogers. They were thrown together at the last moment. They were sort of third bananas in the movie, flying down to Rio. And in that movie, all anyone remembers is the two of them dancing the carioca together, and some extraordinary thing happened. And then from then on, it was going from strength to strength. It was dazzling, and they became one of the great money-making couples of Hollywood throughout the 30s.
Well, that's so interesting, because you write in the book that Ginger Rogers was not the most polished dancer of the lot, that that she was quite inexperienced, and that really was the key to their success, maybe, because he trained her to dance his way with him. Is that not right?
I think so. That's my sort of feeling about it all. You know, there's this remark. It's a very amusing remark. It was made by Ann Richards, the governor of Texas, I think at the 1980 convention. She said of she was sort of pushing women's rights and feminism, and she said, you know, let's remember that Ginger Rogers did everything Fred Astaire did, but in high heels and backwards. It's a great remark. And she did, indeed. But I would only say that Fred sort of taught her to do it in high heels and backwards. You know, he danced with Sid Charisse, Rita Hayworth, Leslie Caron, all women, Eleanor Powell, who had real dance training. Ginger Rogers didn't. She was a sort of Charleston champion from Texas, but what she had was she was a great actress. And when Fred Astaire sang to her, she knew how to take a song, you know. And she also had the perfect, I think, figure for Fred Astaire.
Mm.
She was 5'3" and weighed about 105 pounds. She had marvelous legs and this sort of perfect back. And they together they had what the dance critics call this, you know, exquisite line. The two bodies together just worked perfectly in that way.
They worked perfectly together, although they didn't much like each other, which we will talk about more after the break. So much to get to. Joseph Epstein, stick with us. We're talking about the life and legacy of Fred Astaire. You can join our conversation. What was it about Fred Astaire that set him apart from, say, Gene Kelly or James Cagney, the other great dancers of his time? In the age of reality TV, when anyone and everyone dances, what keeps Fred a cut above the rest? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I give a vow to adore you. I'm starting now to be much more positive. I'm left without a penny. The wolf was not smart. He left me my heart, and so I cannot go for anything but the love of the perfectly swell romance.
If you want to learn this yamming art, put your heels together and your toes apart. Stretch your two arms out. That's the way to start. Yam. First, you're side by side, then you walk it slow.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Behind me, that music, Fred Astaire, explaining the steps to the yam in the 1938 film Carefree. We're talking this hour about Fred Astaire, Hollywood's iconic song and dance man. And you can join the conversation. Did Fred Astaire inspire you? What's your favorite Fred Astaire scene? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joseph Epstein is with us. He's an eminent essayist and author of Fred Astaire, the new book just out. We left before the break talking about Ginger Rogers, this dazzling duo he and Fred Astaire. She was a gifted actress in her own right, a comedian, ingenue of sorts.
Yes. Well, you know, she won an Oscar for the movie Kitty Foyle. And she really was brilliant as an actress. And neither of them, Fred Astaire nor Ginger Rogers, was keen to keep this partnership going. They both wanted to pull away from it.
Was that because of their dislike for each other?
Well, I wouldn't say it was a dislike, but there was a kind of funny coldness about it. I think, again, it touches on the question of snobbery. Fred Astaire, when he married a woman who was, as they used to say, a kind of capital H socialite, or a woman named Phyllis, whose uncle was the head of the Turf Society in New York and that sort of thing. And I think she looked down a bit on Ginger Rogers, who was kind of just a girl from Texas. And I think it put a certain tension into things. When you read the two autobiographies of the performers, Ginger and Fred, each treats each other with a kind of coldness. I mean, there's not the warmth you would think, since, you know, their claim to history would be much less without each other. What kept them together, of course, is money. The movies were so successful that even though each wanted to break away and go off on his own, it just wasn't possible. There was too much money to be made, and that's, you know, behind show, without sounding like a Marxist, money was really what so much of show business is about.
Yes, indeed. You write in the book that Astaire, quote, acted the part was given to him at the end of the day like a good artisan, packed up his tools and returned home. He didn't dwell much on the emotion of the relationship. And you also write that Rogers feared of being, quote, smothered under Astaire's brilliance.
There's a lot to that.
He didn't much respect her as a dancer?
I don't think it's quite that, but it was always Astaire and Rogers, you know, and then Fred Astaire danced, as I say, with all these other people, but it didn't quite work at nearly as well. Part of my theory is that, not that it's a theory, just a notion really, is that Fred Astaire's dancing isn't about sexiness. It's about glamour. It's about suavity. It's about urbanity. And when he danced with dazzling women, you know, like Rita Hayworth and Sid Charisse, there was some disproportion. It wasn't quite right. You know, Ginger Rogers, there was a proportionality to the look and feel of the both of them that was just perfect.
Made 10 musical films together, and correct. I want to play a clip from Let's Call the Whole Thing Off, from this 1937 film, Shall We Dance?
You like pajamas, and I like pajamas. I'll wear pajamas and give up pajamas. For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling off. Oh, let's call the whole thing off.
You say laughter, and I say laughter. You say after, and I say after. Laughter, laughter, after, after. Let's call the whole thing off. You like Havana, and I like Havana.
Beyond the chemistry, you say in the book that they never lost the common touch. She was also a Midwesterner, born in Missouri.
Yes, exactly. Well, the great trick between the whole Fred Astaire persona, I came to feel, was that he somehow established himself as a democratic aristocrat, oxymoronic phrase, you'd think. But there's something so, you know, his accent took on a kind of mid-Atlantic feel. He dressed as if he were himself a duke, and yet he never seemed a snobbish figure in these movies. They always gave him jobs, you know, in the movies. He was a band leader, he's a gambler, he's a hoofer. He has names like Pete Peterson and Huck Huckabee, and he's always this, yet he dresses so dazzlingly, and he behaves so aristocratically. And he somehow combined the small-town guy with the wonderfully polished aristocrat that brought it off.
You talk about his style in the book, which I so enjoyed. You talk about his clothing and the sports coats, the pliant, richly textured, buttery, soft sports jackets. You say Astaire would throw his new Seville Row suits against the wall before he wore them to, quote, get the stiff squareness out.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Absolutely. What he, I think, understood about clothes is, number one, they can be witty and amusing things in themselves. And number two, while being, you know, fascinated by them, if you go too far with clothes, a man does, a kind of silly vanity comes out and a foppishness, and it doesn't work, and you become somehow offensively overdressed. And he had a way of understanding how to do this, to get clothes just right. I think he also dressed to make himself look taller. As I looked at the movies while I was writing this book, whenever there are other people in the room, he's almost always the smallest man. But he didn't look small. He was, in fact, I don't know. I think he was about 5'7", long-legged. He wore these English coats, sort of with tight around the upper arms, and short jackets that made him look larger. He was never more than 135 pounds. He working as hard as he did as a dancer, diet was absurd. He was once supposed to have said, "What's a calorie? I don't understand this this concept."
You talk so much in the book about how he was such a great performer and also a very simple man and quite unusual by Hollywood standards. He despised publicity. He appeared to have been a fierce monogamist, a regular churchgoer?
Yes. Fierce monogamist is good. I wish I had that phrase.
Yeah, decidedly Republican in his politics, you write. And yet, for all his anti-movie star qualities, Astaire was the quintessential Hollywood glamour man. Never let his fans down, never developed a pouch, always dressed impeccably till the end, and remained a graceful dancer late in his life.
Yeah, absolutely. He had, I have a chapter about a woman coming to interview him, a woman named Helen Lawrence, and she, you know, obviously wanted all the dirt in the interview, and Fred Astaire just wasn't going to give her an inch. The fact is there wasn't much dirt to give. The only real sort of Fred Astaire story is his father. There's a kind of rumor that his father, when the mother took the children off, that the father made another a young woman pregnant, but nobody knows this. Fred Astaire always defended his father. And then late in life, as you recall, he was 80, he married a woman, a jockey, 35, a woman named Robin Smith, a female jockey. And people try to make things over that. But there, it was a pretty quiet life, as you say. Mm-hmm. He was notoriously heterosexual and fiercely, what was your phrase?
Monogamous.
Monogamous, mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Joseph Epstein, let's bring some callers into this conversation. First from Paso Robles, California, Marcia is on the line. Hi, Marcia. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for taking my call,
sure.
Jane.
You bet. Go ahead.
I really appreciate the topic. Fred Astaire is one that I've admired throughout my lifetime. I was fortunate enough to watch him as a very young person and must say that I was inspired into dancing by his example.
You saw him. What was that experience like, Marcia?
I have never seen anyone so elegant and so well prepared to present his elegance and love to the world.
Mm-hmm. That's nicely put. You know, there's Fred Astaire never spoke about art. I don't think the word ever crossed his lips. All the greatest dancers of his time, and I don't mean simply show business dancers, but I mean Balanchine, Nureyev, Margot Fonteyn, Baryshnikov more recently, all say that Fred Astaire was the greatest dancer of the 20th century.
Right.
Merce Cunningham is another figure who said this. He never spoke about art. He just said, I'm a hoofer. I made a pretty good buck at this. He would say things like that. And art never came into it. At the end of his life, there was one of these movie tributes to him, American Institute of Film tributes. And his co-choreographer in some of these movies, a man named Hermes Pan, got up and said, you know, Fred, I was in Italy just last month, and there was the magazine Tempo Presente had you on the cover, and they said you represented everything that was finest about America. And the camera went over to Fred Astaire, who was then 84 or 5, and he just kind of waved his hand as if to say, knock that crap off, you know, come on, you know. So there was a kind of wonderful absence of pretension, but yet there was all the dedication of the true artist. You know, he did, I think I read somewhere, 110 different movie dances, and he never wanted to repeat himself. Mm. So there was, you know, there's all that work.
Yeah, you wrote that in the book. I've always tried, he says, to carry out my steadfast rule of never repeating anything in a dance that I've done before.
You know, it's astonishing, really.
You know, we think of Fred Astaire as the dancer, but he was also an extraordinarily fine singer. And as you write in the book, the Gershwins, Cole Porter, Jerome Kern, Dorothy Fields, all of them went on the record to say that they took special pleasure in writing music for him, that no one interpreted their music quite like Fred Astaire.
Yeah, no, he was they speak of a singer. He was a kind of composer-singer. I don't think he's ever got enough credit quite, although people who really know jazz admire Fred Astaire greatly. There are two CDs, if anyone's in the market for trying to find Fred Astaire music, there are two CDs that he did with Oscar Peterson and a marvelous jazz ensemble where he's just in a studio. You don't have the big orchestral effects. And they're just marvelous. I find I play them over and over again, you know. He had this, people said he had this sort of warbly voice. It was a thin voice. But somehow his, you know, his enunciation was perfect. He also danced as a kind of sang as a singer's dancer. Everything had this kind of rhythm in it. It's why you want to get up and dance yourself when
it's
he sings.
It's the feeling in it that you see and hear from him. Yeah.
Right. He also had something I was going to just mention, a word that I learned when I was trying to think about his singing. He had, he sort of did this sort of, the word is palandro, an Italian word, which means a kind of talking singing, you know. So a song starts out, I just got an invitation in the mails, you know, and then he goes on, you know, we're dancing, my top hat, white tie and tails. You know? So palandro.
Ah, that's wonderful. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining us from New York City is Elizabeth Kendall. She's a longtime dance critic and historian, now a professor at Eugene Lang College at the New School of Liberal Arts. She's author of The Runaway Bride, Hollywood Romantic Comedy in the 1930s, and Autobiography of a Wardrobe, out in paperback next month. Elizabeth, great to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Elizabeth.
What were Fred Astaire's contributions to the world of dance, generally speaking, to your mind? What did he do that nobody else quite could?
Well, you all have just talked so wonderfully about his skills as a dancer and as a singer, and Joseph, you melded those skills together as they should be linked. But he was also an amazing choreographer. All those dances that you see him doing on TV, they didn't spring out of nowhere. They came from his working them out. He made them.
Did his style change over time, Elizabeth?
Well, Jane, yes, it did, because he grew like any true artist, even if he didn't like the word. He really kind of invented. He had two styles as a choreographer. He had the solo, sometimes duo, rhythmic, percussive comment on the music. And then he had the adagio style, which in dance and music means slow, lyrical, drawn out. And those were the romantic numbers that we all know from the films. He really mixed tap with that kind of lyrical expression. He was the master of that. He had a chance to work on the RKO lot out. He had a chance to work out a new mode of show dance, and he did. And you can see the richness and the depth of those romantic lyric percussive also numbers growing as the movies get more complicated dance-wise.
Let me bring a caller into this conversation before our next break. Here, Christopher is on the line from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Christopher. Appreciate you waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I was a professional dancer, professional ballet dancer for 23 years, and now I'm a faculty member of Boston Ballet School out here. And growing up as a dancer, Fred Astaire was a huge hero for me. Mm. And a few points I'd like to make and a question, and I'll take my answer off the air, is one thing that struck me so beautifully about Fred Astaire is that you could see the joy of his dance when he danced. He was extremely professional, perhaps the consummate professional as a dancer, and his whole body dance, there was always joy. You could see that he was in the present moment when he was performing. And finally, I would like to know something about his training, because I think that's always very interesting for dancers and people to learn about where he was trained, how he was trained, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Christopher, thank you very much. Joseph Epstein, would you respond?
Well, I was going to say, Christopher makes a good point when he talks about being a full-body dancer. I think, and Elizabeth will tell me if I've got this right or wrong, but one of the things that Fred Astaire did as a movie dancer is insist on a kind of full-body photographing of the dancer. Instead of going to the dancer's feet or looking at the joy on his face, the camera moving, he had the camera on his body full-time. And it meant that he had to control every part of his body. One of the odd things about Fred Astaire's physique, which I mention in the book, is Fred Astaire had an extraordinarily large hands. And these hands were a kind of problem. They were sort of farm boy's hands, you know, what they used to call real meat hooks, you know. And he had to somehow always kind of disguise the largeness of these hands. And if you look at the movies in future, you can see he kind of curls up his middle fingers to make them smaller.
That's so interesting. Well, Elizabeth, I'll let you jump in after this break. I'm sorry I have to go to commercial here. You can join the conversation, listeners, 1-800-423-8255. We are talking about Fred Astaire this hour. Much more to come and more of your calls. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
I'll go my way by myself, like a bird on the wing. I'll face the unknown, I'll build a world of my own. No one knows better than I myself. I'm by myself alone.
I'm putting on the top hat, tying up a white tie, brushing off my tails.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the remarkable life and legacy of Fred Astaire. We're hearing Top Hat, White Tie, and Tails from a 1952 recording session with jazz composer Oscar Peterson. You can join our conversation. What gets you out on the dance floor? Do you see Fred Astaire's legacy in today's dance craze? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joseph Epstein is with us. He's an essayist and cultural critic. His fantastic new book is called Fred Astaire. Elizabeth Kendall is also with us. She's a dance critic and author of The Runaway Bride, Hollywood romantic comedy in the 1930s. Elizabeth, I'll let you respond to the caller, Christopher, before the break, who talked about Fred Astaire's whole body movement as a dancer and the joy he had when he moved.
Well, it's a wonderful point, and Christopher belongs to your wonderful Boston Ballet, an unusually very fine operation. Christopher also had a question about Astaire's training, which I think Joseph addressed in his book. But Fred Astaire really grew up in the theater and was trained by things we can't even know about that he saw in vaudeville. From the age of six, he was backstage and on stage. He did have training in some of the schools in New York that taught a little bit of everything to get people onto the headlines in vaudeville. But I want to take this moment to gently stick up for Ginger's training, Joseph, because she too, she grew up in vaudeville too. And sure, she was born in Missouri, where I was also born, but she grew up in Texas, won some little Charleston contest. But in Texas, to win a Charleston contest, you got to know how to Charleston. And she then went on the circuit, and you can't stand still and sing in vaudeville. She danced as much as she sang, and grew up just the same as Astaire, watching everything else that she was on the stage with.
Joseph Epstein, did she get a bad rap, Joseph?
No, I immediately apologize. As a matter of fact, if it were television, you'd see a white flag waving back and forth. It's
white flag, white flag acknowledged and embraced.
Exactly. No, it's true. But I think what Elizabeth's point is that, you know, the kind of dancing they both did was OJT, on-job training. You know, you just picked up things, what worked, if you think of how difficult it is to be entertaining, just moving your feet around.
And something more.
It's astonishing.
Something more. Astaire was homeless, if you want to call it that, from the age of six. He was in a world of three, him and his mom and Adele. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a fatherless world, and the fathers in vaudeville kind of took in those kids. We see an example of the fatherless tap kid who took all his fathers from the world of tap in Savion Glover, a great contemporary tap dancer, who is a contemporary almost version of Astaire. He's just as imaginative in what he does with the art, and he's just as fanatic about capturing the spirit of his time in his body and his rhythms. And Savion acknowledges all the black tappers and other tappers who went before him. Astaire did his own version of acknowledging black and white father tappers, especially in the Bojangles tribute in Swing Time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, someone we haven't talked about at all, Jane, is Gene Kelly.
Well, that's right.
Who I have a chapter called The Other Guy. It seems to me that, you know, one doesn't have to make these choices in a stark way, but somehow we do. You know, is it Mozart or Beethoven? Is
elegance it or athleticism in your
yes,
book?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Tolstoy or Dostoevsky?
Mozart and, or Salieri.
Yes, better yet. I prefer of the two, Kelly and Astaire. I think of Astaire as more Apollonian, more classical. Kelly had a very different program. He was a much more ambitious artist than Astaire in the sense that he wanted to proletarianize dance. He wanted to he had a great thing about making dance a masculine and athletic thing. And in a way,
yeah, this is a great point.
You know, in a way, Astaire was a dancer of the 20s and Kelly of the 30s. I found that Kelly called almost too much attention to himself. John Gielgud, who was not a dancer or a dance critic, says somewhere that the thing a great male dancer does is make his partners look awfully good. Mm-hmm. You know, and Astaire did that while also not submerging himself in some way.
He was a generous performer. There's also a point in your book, Joseph, that I'd like to bring up. Gene mm-hmm. Kelly, Fred Astaire, a good measure of the success behind these men is owed to the fact that they came together at a time when there was an extraordinary clutch of great songwriters at
absolutely,
work.
Irving
absolutely. Berlin and others, no?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Jerome Kern, George Gershwin.
Right.
Our classic American leader,
yeah,
composers.
It's a clutch of talent that's never been duplicated and probably never will. The whole
Arthur Schwartz.
Exactly. The Dancing in the Dark.
Three
things I think were working for Fred Astaire. One is the immense movie-going audience of the time. I think they said in the 40s, I read somewhere, that of a population of 150 million Americans, 90 million went to the movies at least once a week. Hmm. There weren't rivaling media in those days.
It was a community.
Absolutely. The other thing was, of course, that Astaire gave this sort of charming fantasy in the middle of the Depression of elegance, you know, of tuxedos, of these wonderful sets that were done for these movies. And there was that. And above all, the great composers,
great
song show composers. These three things kind of came together to make for an astonishing career.
I must go back to the phones. Buffalo, New York. Robert is on the line. Hi, Buffalo. Appreciate you waiting, Robert. Thanks.
Yeah, I think this is a very important comment on the character of the man. At some point in his career, I think it was the movie where he was with a Russian and they danced, that he would not dance with women, that he could be the father or the grandfather. I mean, that's
very young women.
His integrity. I want to comment on that. And the other thing I want to say is, boy, if you can pull a dance off with a coat rack, that's really...
It's an interesting point, Robert. Thanks. Joseph Epstein, he wouldn't dance with very young women, thought it was inappropriate.
That's not quite accurate. You know,
Leslie Caron was pretty young.
Exactly. And there was a 30-year difference between Fred Astaire and Audrey Hepburn in Funny Face. I think it was a problem in that, and the problem was precisely this. How do you not seem like a dirty old man? You know, if you're 30 years older than your partner, you've got this question of how do I still make this romantic with not making it seem unseemly? And I think, he did it, but he was aware of the problem. And very late in life, of course, he danced on television with Barry Chase, whom some say was among his most, the partners he loved most of all to dance with, where the dance was more than 30 years. But at that point, I think it became romantic. The element of romance didn't enter in. I think it was just two people loving to dance, two elegant people doing it very well.
I'm curious what you both think. Excuse me, Elizabeth. I was just going to ask you both about what you think of dance culture today. Shows that are revived Dancing with the Stars and others like it. This is a style of ballroom dance that's being modernized and reinvented for a new audience. I want to listen to a clip from Dancing with the Stars in its eighth season. This is a clip from Monday's show. Gold medal gymnast Sean Johnson, partnered with a professional dancer, has just finished performing a rumba for the sixth week of competition, and the crowd goes wild. Here's Tom Bergeron with analysis from Italian choreographer Bruno Toniglio.
Wow. There you go. First standing O. Come on in here. Come on up here. All right, Bruno, we'll start with you.
Oh, Sean, that was so beautifully pure. It was almost angelic. The innocent side of romance unfolding in front of me, and yet again, sometimes I can see the hint of the devil. Devil sometimes is not bad. You have to push a little bit more on the hip action, and it will make it even better.
There's the judge appraising Sean Johnson for a rumba. Well done. But I'm curious, Joseph Epstein, are reality TV shows bringing ballroom dance to a new generation, appropriately so, to your mind?
I'm going to toss that to Elizabeth to begin with, and I'll say something afterwards.
Okay, Elizabeth.
I think it's great that the show has so much popularity, and it's very interesting. It's almost inexplicably interesting. I want to say a word for Lil' Kim. I think she's doing just great.
You think she's going to make
tango.
It?
And her tango. Yeah, she has that beautiful theatrical concentration where her head is still and you know that she's all there.
But
I think
Elizabeth,
Sean is doing fine, too.
Can athletes and country singers bring fans to dancing in the same way that Fred Astaire did?
Well, think about the other partner, who's always a professional,
exactly.
So that and has worked like mad with the people. And Sean, a gymnast, has a lot of physical ease already. But I want to just skew it a little bit towards choreography, which is the most mysterious art for Americans. It's how you put dances together. Mm. It's how you put one step together with another to make the steps sing as well as the music sing. And Fred Astaire was so key in giving ballroom dancing a content, a lot of steps that are beautiful to look at, but they're also saying they're all about, how do you say a million times, I am with you, I am near you, I'm intimate with you, we are moving together and magically. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that you see them dance, it's now pretty regulated and it's been contested up the gazoo. But nevertheless, Fred Astaire kind of helped introduce the idea that there was something that could be dramatically conveyed in a ballroom dance besides just steps.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. You know, Balanchine, who's a great sort of little god in my pantheon of gods, says at some point,
Balanchine is my head god.
Oh, good. I'll see you at church next week.
Yeah, on the promenade.
But he says at some point, the thing about dance, he says, is you can't say mother-in-law with your feet. You know, it has to be sort of a paraverbal, and that's the genius of choreography. I mean, it's part of the genius of it, certainly.
Yes, and Fred Astaire, sure, he gets credit for the reemergence of ballroom dance as something that's talked about in ordinary American households with a strange route through reality TV. But Fred Astaire also gets credit for some of Balanchine's vision of what he could do combining Russian classical ballet with the tempo of the America that he came to in the 30s and embraced.
No, that's very
interesting. Balanchine's classical ballets are way more syncopated than anybody else's ballets. You can almost do them jazz-like. And some of them are, in fact, many of them have jazz references in
absolutely.
Them.
Let me jump in here. I must get some more calls in. Barton, Vermont is where Peter is calling from. Peter, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm a musician. Most of my life I played in Broadway and Radio City. But I want to say, as a musician, I never, never saw anybody could beat out rhythms with his feet. He was a fantastic percussionist. The offbeat rhythm that he did, it's just mind-boggling what he can do. Even when he walks, he's just a rhythmic person. Mm-hmm. There's no one that could ever duplicate Fred Astaire, in my opinion.
Peter, thank you. Thank you. It was innate, wasn't it?
You know, this reminds me, Peter's remark reminds me that in the late 30s, Fred Astaire did a show for Packard Motor Company, in which he danced on the radio. What a remarkable thing, you know. Mm. I mean, it was essentially like listening to Gene Krupa or someone, you know, feet as a percussion instrument.
But that's what we have. Oh, can I jump in for one second? That's what we have as an American art, as an American dance art. We have the whole undercurrent and often overcurrent of percussion from African music that combined with what European melodic and rhythmic conventions to make that very, very rich field of rhythm that's under most good American music and dance. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Here's another call from Bolton, Massachusetts. Steve is on the line. Thank you for waiting, Steve.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Couple points. First off, I think everybody's bypassed. You talked about it before a little bit on athleticism versus style, but you know, Fred Astaire was extremely athletic. If you watch some of his movies, he's got one where he does something in slow motion while the background dances are in regular time, and his form is just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. The other point I want to make, too, is what I enjoyed about his movies was he always seemed to have the same actors playing similar roles, a little bit of consistency there in his movies from the late 30s and the early 40s. And finally, my favorite movie was Bandwagon.
Good memory, Steve. Thank you. Joseph?
Well, one of the things I was going to say, you know, there are not many people still alive who had adult consciousness to watch these 30s movies when they came out. You know, you'd have to be in your early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And most of us have come to this movie, to the Fred Astaire Ginger movies through Turner Classics, through, you know, earlier television before that, DVDs. And they're endlessly revived and they stay endlessly alive, which is the great, great miracle of them.
So after all your research, Joseph Epstein, in our final moments here, what do you wish to express or to leave people with about the extraordinary Fred Astaire?
Well, you know, I've given a talk or two about this book, and when I have given the talk, at the end of the talk, I often play the song Dancing in the Dark, which has the line, we're waltzing in the wonder of why we're here, time hurries by.
Time hurries by, we're here.
We're here and gone.
And gone.
And I think that in some ways that's the underlying message, if there is such a message in Fred Astaire's life, and that is, we're here so short a while. Why not be elegant, suave, get the most out of life through this kind of sustained elegance?
Just a delightful conversation. Uh-huh. Many thanks to my guests, Elizabeth Kendall, a dance critic and historian, author of Autobiography of a Wardrobe, out in paperback next month. Elizabeth, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you,
my
Jane.
Pleasure.
Joseph Epstein is an essayist and author of Fred Astaire. What a terrific book. I so appreciate your time. Thank you, Joseph.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll go out with Dancing in the Dark, featured in the 1953 film The Bandwagon. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I have you, love, and we can face the music together. Dancing in the dark.